From Storyflow, this is your daily audio brief for June 28th. Hey, it's Riley. June 28th, 10 things to be aware of before the day starts. Let's get into it. First, from Fies.org, the oldest evidence of mourning rituals reveals Paleolithic communities grieved like we do. A team of archaeologists examined a 27,500-year-old site in Liguria, Italy, where a teenage boy's skeleton showed a fatal bear attack. The bones are clearly broken in the jaw, neck, and shoulder, matching the trauma you'd expect from a large predator. What's striking is that the remains weren't left exposed. They were carefully placed in a shallow pit and covered with stones and ochre, a practice that suggests intentional burial. The researchers also found a few small shells and a handful of animal teeth nearby, items that don't belong to the boy but may have been added as symbolic gestures. Because this is a single, well-preserved find, the evidence is limited, but the context points to a deliberate act of mourning rather than a hasty disposal. In short, the burial shows that even in the Upper Paleolithic, people responded to death with care and ritual much like we do today. It's a modest glimpse, but it nudges our understanding of early human empathy and social bonds. Next, second, from OMG Ubuntu, run a 30-year-old version of GIMP on modern Linux via Flatpak. Ever wondered what GIMP looked like in 1996, before GTK? Well, now you can. Developer Baluei has packaged GIMP 0.54 as a Flatpak that runs on modern 64-bit Linux desktops with Wayland. It's apparently the earliest version of the app with the source code still available to build. It's not an official GIMP effort, but an enthusiast project hosted on the GNOME GitLab. It's also something of a work-in-progress package of an ancient work-in-progress beta release, with the maintainer promising more plugins and tutorials in time. Before we get to the install bit, there is a bit of trivia-laden history or reading run a 30-year-old version of GIMP on modern Linux via Flatpak, a blog post from OMG Ubuntu. Do not reproduce elsewhere without permission. Up next, third, from Collider. The wait is almost over for Disney's biggest summer blockbuster. Disney's live-action remakes have been on a bit of a roller coaster lately, and the studio's next big summer release is feeling the pressure to pull the audience back in. The last few years gave us some huge wins, think Alice in Wonderland and Beauty and the Beast, each topping the $1 billion mark worldwide. Those successes set a high bar, but the newer titles haven't quite hit the same stride. The Little Mermaid and Snow White both opened to mixed reactions, and the numbers tell the story. Snow White, for instance, pulled in just over $200 million globally, which is a solid figure but still shy of its $336 million budget. That shortfall has sparked a lot of chatter about whether the formula is losing its magic. What's interesting is how much of the conversation has shifted from pure box office performance to the surrounding controversy, casting choices, thematic updates, and the cultural debates that come with them. Those poisonous rhetoric threads have been swirling around each new release, and they are adding an extra layer of uncertainty for Disney's next move. All eyes are on the upcoming film next month, because it could be the safe bet the studio needs to steady the ship. Whether audiences will embrace it or keep the skepticism going remains to be seen, but the stakes feel higher than ever for Disney's live-action lineup. And then, fourth, from Screen Rant, 12 years later, Naruto's best quote proves fans are missing the point of Boruto. The piece starts by reminding us why Naruto still feels so big. The fights, the tears, the whole never give up vibe that sold hundreds of millions of books and turned into an endless stream of anime, games, and merch. But after the original series wrapped, the franchise kept going with Boruto, the story about Naruto's kid, and that's where the controversy lies. The core of the argument hinges on a line from the original Naruto, something like, "The next generation will surpass the previous one." Fans have been hanging onto that quote, using it as a yardstick to judge Boruto, and the article says they're missing the point. Instead of seeing it as a promise that the new heroes will be better, they've turned it into a demand that Boruto must outshine Naruto in every way, which fuels a lot of the backlash. What the writer points out is that the quote isn't a challenge to the sequel, it's a reminder that each era brings its own struggles and growth. Boruto isn't supposed to be a carbon copy of Naruto's story, but a fresh take on the same themes: friendship, responsibility, and the weight of legacy. The article argues that the criticism often comes from nostalgia, not from the actual narrative quality. The piece also notes that the Boruto manga, led by Mikio Ikemoto and Masashi Kishimoto, has actually delivered some solid moments that echo the original's heart, even if the pacing feels different. The criticism, it says, is less about the story itself and more about fans clinging to the past and refusing to let the new characters find their own footing. In short, The article suggests we stop using that old quote as a litmus test and start judging Boruto on its own terms, seeing it as a continuation of the spirit of Naruto, not a direct competition.
If we do that, the series might finally get the appreciation it's been fighting for. Next, fifth, from Cabana, Sunday Reading, A Fantasy Cottage in Palm Beach, A Travel Guide to Capalbio, and Other New Cabana Stories You May Have Missed.
From A Fantasy Guest Cottage in Palm Beach, designed by American interior designer David Lucido, to A Cotswolds Manor's newly transformed gardens and insiders' travel guides to Greece, Italy, and Montenegro, here are some new articles you may have missed over on the world of Cabana.
For returning clients, interior designer David Lucido transformed a modest guest house into a transportive retreat using floral fabrics, painted floors, and a palette drawn from sun-drenched destinations. He talks to Busola Evans.
Once marshland, Capalbio has transformed into one of Maremma's most captivating escapes. From its reclaimed landscapes to its rise as a haven for artists, intellectuals, and travelers, this Tuscan hill town combines wild natural beauty, Mediterranean charm, and a timeless atmosphere. British landscape designer Elizabeth Tyler transformed a historic Cotswolds Manor's grounds into a sequence of distinct yet interconnected spaces.
The Zetter Bloomsbury, designed by British interior decorator and antiques expert James Thurston Waterworth, opened its doors this spring in the shadow of the British Museum, taking the neighboring institution as his point of reference. James sourced nearly 2,000 antiques and artifacts for the project.
In a special edition of Cabana's Finders Keepers series, James shares the stories behind 10 exceptional pieces found within this unique hotel.
For Oberto Gili, photography has never been about perfection.
Over a career spent moving between New York, Italy, and some of the world's most fascinating houses, he remains drawn to the details that reveal how people truly live.
As he marks the launch of his new book Everything at Once, published by Cabana, Oberto reflects on curiosity, observation, and the enduring pleasure of finding meaning in the things others might overlook.
Cabana's latest travel guide, A Weekend in Greece, drew London's Hellenic and Greece-loving crowd to Pavilion Press in Chelsea for a lively launch breakfast, where editors, tastemakers, and longtime Greece insiders gathered to support the magazine's newest and beautifully curated travel companion.
The tiny nation of Montenegro is the unsung gem of the Adriatic coast, an ancient land where writers, poets, intrepid travelers, and adventurers have long been seduced by mountains, monasteries, secret beaches, and medieval fortresses.
Fabrizia Caraxillo shares an insider's guide. With the help of interior architect and designer Carolina Malahi, entrepreneur Julia Hardogs transformed a tired mid-century townhouse in Sao Paulo, Brazil, into a serene retreat layered with family heirlooms, Brazilian modernism, and a deeply personal history. A small, particular stretch between Plymouth and Exeter, caught between the windswept vastness of Dartmoor and the softer, almost turquoise coastline, is where Paul Eldwyn Glade's heart lies. The designer and creative director shares his favorite spots in this singular pocket of the English coast.
For more house tours, insider travel guides, inspirational interviews, Cabana films, and more, visit the world of Cabana at cabanamagazine.com. Up next, sixth, from The Guardian Sport,
Alphonso Davies' return brightens Canada's landmark World Cup moment. The Bayern Munich star changed the game when he came on, opening the space for Steven Eustaquio to shoot from for the match winner for 75 minutes. Canada and South Africa struggled to find a way to break through in the World Cup's inaugural round of 32 clash.
Neither team ceded an inch. Canada couldn't be baited into intensifying its press as South Africa dawdled playing out from the back. South Africa worked to advance upfield but struggled to find dangerous avenues into the box. Then, at long last, 345 minutes into Canada's tournament, Alphonso Davies crossed the touchline for his first involvement at World Cup 2026. The game, for Canada and neutrals alike, greatly benefited.
Continue reading and then, seventh, from Daring Fireball, The New York Times, Am Malik, whose blog shaped how Silicon Valley saw itself, dies at 59.
Clay Risen, writing for The New York Times, Mr.
Malik started his blog just as the dot-com bubble burst, leading to a recession that also took down many of the journalism startups that wrote about tech, like the Industry Standard and Inside.com. He was among the most prominent of the writers who quickly filled the gap, covering Silicon Valley with a mixture of hot scoops and sharp opinions that quickly made Gigam a must-read.
The Android OS leaves me feeling like one feels 3 hours after having Chinese food. A tad empty, he wrote in a 2010 post that neatly summarized Google's struggles to move beyond its roots as a search platform.
Google has to learn the art of engagement, something particularly challenging.
Lovely, warm, accurate, and fair obituary. This pulled snippet is a great one. Early Android as Chinese takeout is such a deft analogy, and the piece really isn't about Android specifically, but Google institutionally. Not speeds and feeds, but can they make products with a soul, with heart? Om's pessimism was obvious, and I'd say, prescient. He had a rare ability to see around corners, and to pick out from the horde of new companies the ones that were going to make real change. He was an early champion of Slack, the workplace messaging service, and in 2006 he was the first blogger to write extensively about Twitter. He was not a fan. By the late 2010s, he had established himself as a singular figure in the tech industry, an investor, an advisor, a writer, and above all, a moral compass on issues like privacy and the power of big tech. Exactly. Next. 8th, from CryptoBriefing, Israel launches multiple attacks in southern Lebanon amid 2026 ceasefire. Israel's Air Force and artillery units moved into southern Lebanon early this week, pounding a string of sites that intelligence says were linked to Hezbollah's rocket depots. The strikes came just days after a tentative 2026 ceasefire was supposed to lock down the border, and they were coordinated across several fronts, suggesting a broader operational shift rather than a single retaliatory raid. What's striking is how the attacks were timed. They coincided with a lull in fighting on the Gaza front, hinting that Israel may be testing the limits of the ceasefire while keeping pressure on its northern adversary. Ground reports from villages near the border described shattered homes and a growing number of displaced families, underscoring how quickly the fragile calm can dissolve into civilian hardship. Lebanese officials have condemned the moves as a breach of the agreement, calling for an urgent UN intervention. Meanwhile, diplomatic channels are buzzing with calls for restraint, as regional actors worry that any escalation could spill over into a wider confrontation. The episode leaves the ceasefire looking more like a pause than a lasting settlement. Both sides are now watching each other closely, and the next few days will likely determine whether the truce holds or unravels into another round of hostilities. Up next, 9th, from the American Tribune, Founding Brothers, How One Generation of Lees Won the American Revolution and Built America. If you would like to watch it in full without subscribing, you can listen on YouTube or Spotify. If you would like to read it, the rough transcript, with timestamps, is provided below the paywall. Steeped in the stern classical traditions of Greece and Rome, the five younger brothers Thomas Ludwell, Richard Henry, Francis Lightfoot, William, and Arthur Lee found themselves bound together by a shared classical tradition, patriotic American outlook, and bitter domestic feud over their patrimony. Against their overbearing eldest brother, Philip Ludwell Lee, from the splendorous river wharves of Stratford Hall to the quiet gardens of Chantilly on the Potomac, and from the legislative benches of Williamsburg and Philadelphia to the precarious courts of Europe, this chronicle follows five of the greatest men of the Lee family of Virginia as they sacrifice their ease, fortune, and peace to win the American Revolution and build the American Republic. Chapters 000 The Death of Thomas Lee at Stratford Hall 315 How a Classical Education Created Four Founders 1013 Philip Ludwell Lee Colonel Phil Takes Control 1300 The Lee Brothers Work Together but are divided by Thomas's will 2115 Chantilly on the Potomac becomes the base of the founding B. Rothers 2312 How the Lee Brothers Helped Win the American Revolution 2912 William and Arthur Abroad 3305 The Cost of Revolution, Death and Disillusionment 3818 The Legacy of the Lee Brothers of Stratford Hall sources referenced in this episode. I'm an Amazon affiliate. In the winter of 1750, the death of Thomas Lee left his six sons to inherit a massive empire of Tidewater land and transatlantic commerce and inheritance that would ultimately forge them into the most formidable family alliance of the American Revolution. If you would like to support the show at no added cost to yourself, you can do so by using the links below to order and read the sources I used to create this episode. Thanks, J.R. Lee Chronicle, Studies of the Early Generations of the Lees, link in description. Doughty Clifford, The Virginia Dynasties, link in description. Doughty Clifford, The Golden Age, link in description. Doughty Clifford, The Great Plantation, link in description. Wright, Louis B., The First Gentleman of Virginia, link in description. McGoy, J., Kent, Richard Henry Lee of Virginia, link in description. Burt, Nathaniel, First Families, The Making of an American Aristocracy, link in description. Evans, Emery G., It Topping People, The Rise and Decline of Virginia's Old Political Elite, 1680-1790, link in description. Morton, Richard L., Polonia, L. Virginia Volume Roman II Westward Expansion and Prelude to Revolution, 1710-1763, link in description. Potts, Louis W., Arthur Lee, A Virtuous Revolutionary, link in description. Nagel, Paul C., The Lees of Virginia, Seven Generations of an American Dynasty, link in description. Hendrick, Burton J. The Lees of Virginia, link in description. Lee, Kaznove G. And then, 10th, from a ICFO office. Last 2 hours before a ICFO office prices go up. This is the last call for the best investment in your ICFO journey. Today's rate is the lowest it will ever be. Lock in your rate before prices go up after tonight. The lower price is gone. Note, if you're already a paid member or insider, your rate is locked. This doesn't touch you. Consider it a thank you for being in early. If you're on the free tier, this is the moment. We're bringing in more top CFOs and operators as speakers and hosting more live Cloud Masterclasses like last week's, where members can put their questions to a real CFO in real time. The price goes up because the room keeps getting more valuable. Here's what you get as a paid member of ICFO office. Insider members get live experiences and CFO masterclasses real CFOs walk you through live, the files they upload, the questions they ask AI, what outputs they trust and what they ignore, where AI saves time and where it doesn't, open Q&A, live walkthrough, honest discussion of what breaks, how to build an AI native finance function, becoming an AI CFO, plus everything in the paid version. If you want to see how AI is actually used when decisions matter, you'll want to be in the room. This is not a demo. We host live CFO meetings. You can ask questions and challenge. Paid monthly and annual member get premium insights and full archive, get access to deep dives, real-world case studies, and finance-first AI playbooks you won't find anywhere else. Step-by-step AI CFO playbooks. Stay on top of AI in finance trends. Get ideas from CFOs running multinational businesses. Build workflows. Learn advanced financial modeling with AI. Rethink how your team reports, models, and plans with tools that actually work. You can comment under letters and raise your concerns. Participate in chats. Follow us behind the scenes. Get new ideas and start your thread on Substack. No more wasting time on finding the right AI tools. Ask questions directly and get help. Lock in your rate before prices go up. This is the most tactical AI finance network on the internet. If you want in at today's rate, now is the time. Thanks, ICFO office. That's the day.